Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Religious, ethnic, and gender tensions are boiling over in Iran just days ahead of that country's presidential election. There was a rare demonstration by Iranian women yesterday, the same day that 7 bombs exploded in 2 different parts of Iran, killing 10 people and wounding approximately 100. Political violence is unusual in Iran, and a spokesman for Iran's Supreme National Security Council blamed the violence on groups affiliated with Saddam Hussein in neighboring Iraq. Joining us on the line from Iran is Delphine Minuit, Tehran correspondent for the French newspaper Le Figaro. And Delphine, is there any claim of responsibility for these bombings?
So far, we haven't heard about serious groups claiming for the responsibilities. There was a rumor about a specific Arab group in the south who was supposed to claim for the responsibility for what happened over there. But today, when I was going through the local press headlines, it looks like the idea was just to keep silence for the moment on this issue and not trying to speculate too much.
We should explain. The bombings were both in Tehran and then the southern city of Ahvaz, and there was speculation that, as you said, ethnic tensions might have been behind that bombing because there was a rumor that the Iranian government wanted to relocate some of the region's Arab population?
That's right. Iran is made up of different communities, and 3% of the society is made up of the Arab communities. And most of this community is living in Ahvaz, this city in the south of Iran, not that far from the Iraqi border.
Well, and then the other two very large communities are the Shiite and Sunni Muslims. How are tensions between those two groups playing out, especially since Shiites now run both Iran and Iraq, Sunnis sort of relegated to the sidelines in both countries?
So far, we haven't heard about problems between Sunni groups and Shiite groups. Of course, Iran is very concerned about what's going on in Iraq, since the majority of the population is Shiite. But it's very new for Iranians, and that's why there is now a concern in the society of some kind of escalation of the violence, which the Iranian society is not used to.
What do you think of the Security Council's suggestion that the recent spate of violence is from pro-Saddam Hussein Iraqis, or at least tensions coming from across the border?
We have to take it into account, since the Iran-Iraq border is first very large and it's very porous. The Iraqi government always mentioned that they didn't have enough troops to protect the border. But on the other hand, there are some other speculation of maybe the responsibility coming from an Iranian opposition group based in Iraq called the Mujahideen-e-Khar. But for now, again, there is no direct claim, and it's really hard to see what it came from.
Yeah. Can you tell us more about the women's demonstration that happened yesterday, women demanding equal rights, sitting in protest for about an hour, and it's reported that some may have been clubbed and arrested. First of all, how unusual is that demonstration, and how violent did it get?
Usually demonstrations are forbidden in Iran, so these women decided to gather in front of Tehran University without any permission. There were around 200 women gathering, asking for more rights since the revolution, since the Islamic revolution in 1979, many of women's rights have been reduced. For instance, in terms of divorce, or also in terms of access to some jobs. This kind of demonstration is very rare, we can say, in Tehran. But it looks like the Iranian society, the Iranian civil society, is seizing this opportunity of the pre-election time to organize such gatherings. We could witness a few days ago a very, very interesting, let's say, uprising of the society, like this expression of joy in the streets after the Iranian team won to go to the World Cup. All of a sudden, many women even put off their Islamic scarf, which is obligatory in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And for hours and hours, you could see them with their hair. Even some of them were dancing in the crowd. It was a real expression of what they cannot say usually in everyday life in Iran.
Delphine Minoui, a correspondent in Iran for the French newspaper Le Figaro. Delphine, thanks so much.
Thank you.
According to Forbes magazine, Canada's marijuana trade to the U.S. is worth more in dollars than cattle, wheat, and timber exports combined. The U.S. spends billions of dollars each year on Canadian marijuana. It's a huge part of Canada's economy. Nothing except for oil and natural gas brings more revenue to Canada. But exactly how does a huge and illegal cash crop make its way across America's border day after day in the age of homeland security? Robert Sabag writes about the cross-border Canadian pot trade in the July issue of Playboy magazine. Robert, welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin. It's a pleasure.
We want you to paint this picture for us because it's pretty incredible. But first, how did you do it? You travel around with a group of smugglers in Canada who seem very open and willing to tell you about their business. How'd you get them to talk?
Well, no one's more surprised than I about that. I mean, and it's been like that as long as I've been a journalist. And in this case, it's even more startling in that they got in touch with me. I started following this story about a year and a half ago. And, you know, I made a couple of calls up to Canada following a story that came out of Toronto. There was a huge marijuana bust in a Molson brewery up there in which they were growing like 30,000 plants. I think they had 1,000 lights going indoors. Mm. And I just started making calls to the people whose names popped up in the newspaper pieces and got to know some people who knew me, that they knew me by reputation because I had written about drugs in the past.
Snowblind, most particularly, you looked into the cocaine trade in the 70s in that book.
That's correct. And Forbes magazine and other publications had run a lot of articles on the Canadian marijuana business. But the one missing ingredient was, how does it get to the United States and who's bringing it in? And that's what I determined to find out once I got to Vancouver. And it wasn't long after I arrived that I ran into the people that I write about in this article.
One of them, the Prez, there was Gentleman Jim. Describe for us, I mean, you set the scene of these helicopter rides and coming over the mountain ranges. I mean, who are these people and where'd they take you?
Well, what they did is they picked me up at my hotel at about 4 o'clock in the morning, and they drove me into the mountains. Actually, they sent me off with the Prez into the mountains, and we sat there for a while until he looked at his watch and he said, "Here it comes, I can hear it." And we stepped out of the pickup truck that we were in, and up over the ridge came this helicopter. It was very military all of a sudden. I hadn't seen it coming, and apparently the pilot was flying in and out of the canyons right atop the tree line. He set the helicopter down right next to this truck. They loaded it up and dispatched it off to the United States, another load off to market.
So I want to be clear then. You met the pilot on either side of the border, but you did not fly over the border and land with the drugs and put them in the pickup.
That's correct. I was at the pickup point. I watched the onload of the marijuana. I watched the helicopter dispatched to the United States. And not long thereafter, I rendezvoused in Canada with the helicopter pilot and asked him to describe for me what had happened on his flight down and on the other end of the delivery.
Right. Where, let's just the picture he painted of the delivery. There's a guy in the U.S. standing by his pickup.
That's right. The helicopter pilot flew in and out of the canyons to the GPS coordinates that were given to him by the Prez, who was holding 250 pounds of marijuana in 6 or 7 hockey bags. Mm. He rendezvoused at those GPS coordinates with
hockey.
The Prez.
I'm sorry, I just have to stop you there. Hockey. How perfect.
Yes.
That's what they're being used for. But continue.
Yes. I think they were actually custom-made hockey bags. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, the Prez loaded the hockey bags into the helicopter. And the pilot took off, and he flew 40 miles into the United States to the GPS coordinates he had been given there. And what he saw on the ground there was precisely what he had seen on the ground in Canada, and that is a pickup truck sitting in the mountains all alone, surrounded by nothing but wilderness.
And a guy.
And a guy waiting for the pot.
Right.
He circled the area to see that it was clear. He made the drop, and he was no more than a minute on the ground before he turned around, circled the area once more, and headed back to Canada about 50 feet off the tree line.
How many different flights do you think do this in the course of a year?
They said that they had three helicopters in the air all the time, as many days as the weather was good, each helicopter sometimes making three trips a day.
How is that possible? How is that possible in a post-9/11 world?
That is what still puzzles me. I suspect it has to do with their ability to fly below radar. They stay with the tree line, and they go in and out of the canyons. And they're flying in wilderness it's difficult flying terrain and difficult flying weather. You're in the mountains up there. And I asked the pilot if he had ever run into any of these flights that fly interdiction along the border, especially since 9/11. I mean, those flights have been increased dramatically to fly terrorism alerts. And he said he hadn't. I asked him what would happen if he did. He said, if you fuel up last, you win. He was very cavalier about it, and they fly under orange alert. Only red alert grounds their flights. Mm.
They're also very devoted to each other. You said there's sort of rules of the road. If trouble comes, what, they take the guy on the ground before they take the drugs?
That's right. The people at most risk in an operation like this are the people on the U.S. side of the border waiting for the delivery. Of course, in the United States, the laws against marijuana possession and trafficking are much more severe, and the penalties much more severe than they are in Canada. And someone arrested with that amount of pot on the U.S. side faces a serious jail time. And I guess because of the value of the product, if someone wanted to rip him off, his life might be in danger. So when this pilot would fly into the United States, he would see the truck, and he would circle the area to make sure that it were clear, that it was not under observation either by police or by crooks. If, in fact, he saw any kind of, like, police surveillance, his job would be to bring the helicopter down, kick the load out, pick up the catcher, the recipient on the U.S. side, and evacuate him, leaving the truck and the marijuana behind. Mm. The most important thing, they said, was to get the guys out.
The Prez, by the way, how do he strike you? I mean, people, when they come up with an image of a drug smuggler, they're thinking, you know, a scraggly person with a knapsack in some cases. What did you find?
There could be nothing more blue-collar about this fellow. One of the things that I've found about the drug business over the years, one of the things that surprises me is how very much like any ordinary business it is. The kinds of people you would expect to be hockey fans. They're just hard-working, blue-collar people. And the Prez, in particular, was a very soft-spoken, very quiet. He was very efficient in what he did. And, of course, the pilots were that much more than efficient. I mean, talk about derring do. They were the guys that were really in it for the excitement.
Robert Sabaghi writes about the Canadian marijuana trade in the July issue of Playboy magazine. When we come back, we'll talk about just how much money smugglers make exporting Canada's marijuana crop to the U.S. and how this might affect U.S. relations. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Returning to our conversation with Robert Sabag, whose article on Canadian marijuana smugglers appears in the July issue of Playboy magazine. And Bob, you just told us how you watched smugglers move a single shipment of 250 pounds of marijuana into Washington State. You say this group of smugglers alone runs three helicopters each day, making around three or four trips a day. How much time does one of these runs take from start to finish?
The helicopter was on the ground no more than a minute. And they told me it was 40 miles into the United States at 120 knots. So if it was 45 minutes in and 45 minutes back, that's how long it took. And it was no more than a minute on the ground in Washington State.
Well, how big a draw is the U.S. for the Canadian drug grower? You quote Prez as saying, the money's over the border. How much money is it?
I was surprised to find that 85% of the marijuana that's grown there is actually grown for export into the United States. Mm. It only represents 5% of the total of what we smoke down here. They grow more pot in California than all of Canada.
And by the way, when you say that, first of all, two things. When you say that we smoke, you make it very clear you don't.
Yes, right? That's true. Yeah, it's very difficult to explain to these characters. After all, I've written that I actually don't smoke pot. Yeah.
Right. And when you say we, you mean the U.S. It has a huge population that smokes marijuana.
Yes, there are about 15 million pot smokers in the United States,
right.
And
so,
about a tenth of that many in Canada.
So it's a huge market for Canada.
It is a huge market. I would guess that, just to throw some numbers at you, this one operation, these fellows that are dispatching these helicopters, are taking in about $20 million a year. They make about $400,000 a week after expenses, they told me. That's U.S.
Mm.
And I figured out that their one operation accounts for about $500 million in annual export revenue from Canada at wholesale prices in Seattle.
By the way, you start with 250 pounds in these hockey bags in Canada. About an hour later, they're on their way into the U.S. How much has their price increased as they cross that border?
It's just about doubled once it crosses the border.
To about what?
These fellows sell it for about $2,900 a pound in Seattle. If they were to deliver it to Los Angeles, it would be worth $4,000. If they were to deliver it to Atlanta, it would be worth $4,500. But they said the turnover is really the name of the game. And what they do is they deliver in the state of Washington at $2,900
a pound?
A pound, yes.
And you had 250 pounds. Well, there you go.
And that comes out to
carry the three. A lot of money.
I think it's $500,000.
And then you also met the smaller farmers who were doing almost, you know, research centers in their homes growing marijuana.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Well, that's when I was in Toronto. Someone invited me to take a look at his grow, and he had about 200 plants. And he was, very typical, I think. His was a small urban grow. He had 200 plants in his apartment.
Hmm.
He and a roommate were growing these things for their own use and to sell to the Compassion Club up there, which is the medical patients that need marijuana, and also selling it to recreational customers. What I found out going from there to talk to these smugglers in Vancouver, I was told actually by them that the majority of the pot that they smuggle comes from people running fewer than 20 lights. There are people from Vancouver to the Maritimes, and these are the people that are supplying the pot that comes down to the United States.
Yeah. Well, and then on the other hand, you describe huge companies like Advanced Nutrients. Mm-hmm. They're heading for $100 million in profits, and they make a fertilizer that's pretty much developed exclusively for the marijuana industry, and they're a big, thriving company.
They are, and they... I guess what would surprise most people here in the United States is that they're certainly under scrutiny by the government in Canada, but they really don't get hassled in a significant way.
Well,
as
tell
you
us about. I mean, is it do they, do people turn a blind eye? Are there no laws? What and distinguish between laws against smoking and using marijuana and smuggling it?
Well, the Canadian government right now is actually considering decriminalizing possession of small amounts of marijuana. What they're trying to do up there, what they have been trying to do for the past 2 or 3 years, is try to structure laws that enable their citizens to possess up to an ounce of marijuana without being criminalized if they're caught doing so. So in making that happen, what the government has decided to do is they've decided to increase the penalties for growing and for trafficking. However, the penalties wouldn't come close to the penalties that we experience here in the United States.
Do you see some time when the smugglers that you met will be the future Philip Morris of marijuana of Canada?
I wonder. That's an interesting point. I mean, if it were legalized, I don't think these guys would be making $400,000 a week. Mm-hmm. It would be like any other industry.
Mm-hmm. Bob, did you meet anybody along the way, any Canadians, who had any mixed feelings about the fact that they were funneling drugs into the U.S.? Big drug problem. And yes, many think of marijuana as, the safe drug. But there are people who are hooked on it, people who, have drug problems. How do they feel about Americans who were using the product?
Well, I guess the answer is no, Robin. None of them expressed any reservations about that. Very, very few of the people involved in the marijuana business really see the drug as having any kind of pernicious impact. That is not true of I think there are a lot of people in the cocaine business, for example, that know precisely how bad the drug they're selling is and the impact it can have on people.
But you know, I am reading one portion of your article where you came across disdain for Americans' need for marijuana, quoting a wealthy British Columbian grower. And he says, "The U.S. is a consuming nation, a hungry whore, an angry nation. We've got to get them on their medicine."
That's what he said.
Robert Sebag writes about the huge pipeline between Canada and the U.S., the marijuana coming from Canada, the money from U.S. going back up to pay for it, in the July issue of Playboy magazine. And, Bob, it sounds as if, you know, the takeaway notion from all of this is that there's a big conflict on the horizon, I would imagine, between Canada and the U.S. over marijuana.
I suspect that's the case, yes. It's been made very clear by the United States government that it is not going to tolerate decriminalization in Canada. The drug czar, John Walters, has threatened to slow traffic across the border between us and our largest trading partner. The Canadians look at the war on drugs as just one more of the wars that we're waging here that they really can't understand.
Bob Sebag, thanks very much.
Thank you, Robin. It's my pleasure.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush met with the leaders of five African nations today, holding the countries up as models of democracy. This comes after the Group of Eight countries agreed this weekend to one of the biggest debt write-offs ever. The G8 will cancel $40 billion in debt to 18 of the poorest nations in the world, 14 of them in Africa. But critics of aid to Africa say the world's wealthiest countries, the U.S. in particular, need to do more. At the G8 summit in Scotland next month, British Prime Minister Tony Blair will be pushing the rich countries to boost aid to Africa by $50 billion a year by the year 2010. Jeffrey Sachs says that's not enough. Jeffrey Sachs is a Columbia University economist and special advisor to U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan. He joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And you've been highly critical of the Bush administration, saying that they perpetuate a mythology about U.S. aid to Africa. What do you mean?
The United States aid to Africa is tiny. That's all one can say about it. It's certainly not at all commensurate with what the U.S. has promised to do, with what Africa needs, and with what we could afford. President Bush just confuses the issue by saying how much we're doing rather than telling the truth to the American people, at which point they would support doing more.
Polls show that Americans do think that about 24% of the U.S. budget does go to Africa. What is true?
Well, much, much less than 1% of our budget. Right now, the aid to Africa is only $3 billion a year. It's less than 2 days of the Pentagon spending. And when you parse that aid, about $1 billion is just emergency food shipments rather than helping farmers grow more food. And most of the rest is actually for American consultant salaries. When you get right down to it, America has not been helping Africa to make the critical investments in growing more food, controlling disease, and putting in place the infrastructure that would allow Africa to escape from extreme poverty.
Well, President Bush is saying that current U.S. aid to Africa has tripled during his administration to $3.2 billion, and that he wants to make sure that the money goes to countries with open economies and open markets. Is that a valid concern? Because there are a lot of people who feel that money going into Africa goes into a void.
Tripling something that's almost nothing to something that remains almost nothing is no accomplishment. If they would be serious at the White House rather than spinning, they would realize that this $3 billion a year, say compared to a $500 billion military budget, is not getting us security and it's not helping Africa solve its problems. So it's all spin right now. Now, the idea that it should go to open societies that can use this money properly, that's great. All fine. And President Bush said that 3 years, 4 months ago when he announced the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which in this whole period has essentially not dispersed a penny. And in its first 4 years since President Bush made the announcement, we'll spend a few tens of millions of dollars in Africa, it seems now.
in the British newspaper, The Daily Telegraph, a poll showed that 83% of Britons are not confident that new money wouldn't end up in the hands of criminals or corrupt governments. First of all, is that a valid concern? And if there is some concern, how do you ensure that the money isn't wasted?
The question of using this money correctly is an important one, of course. And there are many, many success stories eradicating smallpox. Now we're on the verge of eradicating polio, controlling African river blindness, having immunizations for children. Many successes. They all show the same thing. You need specific deliverables. They should be measurable, and you should audit what you're doing. Nobody should sign a blank check. Nobody should say, here, have some money, do the best you can with it. This should be directed towards priority investments in health, in education, building schools, building clinics, helping children sleep under anti-malaria bed nets, helping farmers grow more food. These are very practical, measurable things that can be done where there's a long track record of how to do it. The one program the White House got started, which was getting people on treatment on AIDS, that program's going forward because, like those others that I mentioned, it has the character of specific, measurable deliverables, and those are being delivered right now.
You mentioned also malaria eradication. Could you stay with that topic for a second, because you've written how that's a perfect example of how new aid money can be very, very targeted, malaria killing up to 3 million children this year.
The cost of one cup of coffee a year for each of the billion people in the rich world, $3 billion, $3 from each of us in the rich world, it would be possible to save the lives of more than 1 million children. All it needs is a distribution of insecticide-treated bed nets throughout Africa.
You write about $7 per net.
That's correct, and about and effective anti-malarial medicines available in the villages. Another directly accomplishable, measurable, monitorable action which the donors have not done.
Well, we began by mentioning debt relief. Nigeria, a country with $36 billion in debt, is not on the list of countries that will receive that debt relief because of concerns over corruption and a lack of transparency. World Bank President Paul Wolfowitz is in Nigeria today. He says he thinks Nigeria is making strides in those areas. How significant is it that Nigeria is left out of that debt relief? How important is that debt relief to these African countries?
Nigeria needs debt relief because the last time that Nigeria could actually pay its debt, the debt was about $15 billion. And the reason that it's at $35 billion now is that it's all unpaid principal and interest that have been added to that original debt. It's been known for 15 years, if not longer, that Nigeria can't afford to pay this debt. And yet the creditors have just lived in their own world of unreality. Now, the fact of the matter is that it was said to Nigeria since President Obasanjo came in as the democratic leader of a new democracy in Nigeria, well, we don't give debt cancellation to oil countries, it was said. But then came Iraq, and within 30 days, President Bush said, I'll have a personal emissary, James Baker III, fly around the world and sew up a debt cancellation deal for Iraq. And those who had been thinking that Nigeria, for its democracy, needed this help, looked on in absolute amazement. Everything that was said to the Nigerians for years was reversed in 30 days when Iraq got its deal.
And Prime Minister Tony Blair is going to make his pitch again in a month at the G8 summit to increase aid to Africa, to double it to about $50 billion a year by 2010. Do you think there's any chance of that being approved?
I think that the White House is going to change because what they've put forward so far makes no sense. It's shockingly small compared to the real stakes at play. This White House is on its watch is letting millions of impoverished people die for absolutely no reason. I think it will change.
Jeffrey Sachs is a Columbia University economist. Jeffrey, thanks for speaking with us.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Still to come, we'll speak to Nell Newman about helping her dad's company go organic. Her dad is Paul Newman, the company Newman's own. You're listening to Here and Now. Mondays in June typically mean rulings from the Supreme Court, as justices try to wrap up business before the summer recess. And today the court issued two rulings. Joining us is Lyle Denniston. He covers the High Court for Here and Now and for SCOTUS blog. Welcome, Lyle.
I am glad to be with you again, Robin.
And the first ruling concerned a man named Thomas Miller L., convicted and sentenced to death for killing a motel clerk in 1985 in Texas. Miller L. is black. He claimed the jury was racially stacked against him, with only one African-American on the panel. The High Court today ordered a new trial for Miller L. On what basis?
Well, the court has had this case before, and earlier it strongly indicated that it agreed with his complaint that the prosecutors had used their automatic strikes, that is, an attempt to remove someone from the jury panel so that they don't serve at the trial on the basis of race. And he claimed that most of the blacks on the jury panel were eliminated by the use of those kind of strikes. The court sent it back down to a lower court, which once again found that the state prosecutors had valid non-racial reasons for keeping the blacks off the jury. But then the court once more today reversed that decision and said more emphatically than before that we are not persuaded these strikes were done for racial purposes. There's no other explanation, and so he's entitled to a new trial without this kind of bias infecting the proceedings.
So this death row inmate is going to have another trial by order of the Supreme Court, and we're reminded that this is a death row inmate in Texas, which executes more inmates than any other state.
Well, also, and there is a lot of commentary among civil liberties groups that Texas is probably the biggest offender in terms of allowing racial factors to influence the criminal justice system. So this is a real signal from the Supreme Court of the United States that they would like to see Texas establish a better record of neutrality, at least as to race, in their criminal justice system.
Well, the court issued another ruling today, this one about drug research. Essentially, the question before the justices was, can researchers begin research on a drug that is already under patent by a rival? How'd the court rule?
Well, the court ruled that Congress had given researchers what's called a safe harbor in lawyers' terms. That is, that they could escape being challenged for infringing on the patent of the pioneering drug that's already on the market if they engage in animal studies with the aim of producing a generic version of that drug, usually a cheaper version of that drug. And the court ruled that this is what Congress intended, saying that Congress intended to give researchers a wide berth as long as they were engaged in the process of developing drugs for later clinical trials with human subjects while they seek approval from the federal government to put these drugs on the market.
Well, the court today refused to be drawn into the dispute over President Bush's power to detain Americans suspected of terrorism. This is the case of Jose Padilla, known as the Dirty Bomber. The court essentially said, let an appeals court handle this. Is that correct? Is that a correct reading?
You have it right, Robin. This case involves Jose Padilla. A year ago, the Supreme Court ruled that the government could designate a suspected terrorist as an enemy combatant and hold him indefinitely, provided that the person was captured in a battlefield overseas. The difference with Jose Padilla's case is that he was not captured overseas. He was captured at O'Hare International Airport in Chicago, and so the case tests the president's power to designate enemy combatants and then to schedule indefinite detention of an American citizen who is not captured in the battle zone. But the court action on Monday was no surprise because the court very rarely allows a case to leapfrog over the Court of Appeals, where Padilla's case is also pending now and will go forward beginning with a hearing in that court in Richmond, Virginia on July 19th.
Well, Lyle, before we let you go, what's left on the docket this term?
Well, the most important cases that we've got for decision between now and the end of this month are cases involving the constitutionality of putting the Ten Commandments on the interior or exterior walls of courthouse buildings or on statehouse grounds. There's a major case on whether or not it's legal to sell software that allows people to download music and movies. And there's a major case on the government's power to seize private property and hand it over to a private developer to make a profit-making new project in a depressed urban area.
Lyle Denniston reports on the Supreme Court for SCOTUS blog. Lyle, thanks for speaking with us.
Always glad to be with you, Robin.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Other news we're following today, the U.S. Senate is apologizing for its failure to outlaw lynching. Between 1882 and 1968, more than 4,700 people, mostly blacks, were lynched. During much of that time, nearly 200 anti-lynching bills were introduced in Congress. None passed. The resolution being heard on the Senate floor today specifically apologizes to the victims of lynching and the descendants of those victims for the failure of the Senate to enact anti-lynching legislation. Descendants of some of those victims will be at Capitol Hill today, including a cousin of Emmett Till, the black teenager killed in Mississippi 50 years ago for reportedly whistling at a white woman. Louisiana's Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu, co-sponsor of the resolution, says lynching and mob violence were an American form of terrorism. Also today, jury selection begins in the trial of reputed Ku Klux Klansman Edgar Ray Killen, who was accused of killing three civil rights workers in 1964. Killen was tried in 1967, but his case ended in a hung jury. Today, the 80-year-old part-time preacher arrived at the courtroom in a wheelchair. The murders of James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner shocked the nation and brought attention to the struggle to register black voters in the South. Their deaths were depicted in the film Mississippi Burning. Nell Newman shares her mother's no-nonsense style and her father's passion for race cars. Nell is the daughter of actors Joanne Woodward and Paul Newman. He taught her to fish, and he also shares her love of food. Paul Newman started his own food dynasty 20 years ago to fund charities such as his Hole in the Wall Gang Camp for kids with cancer. Now Newman's own products are on just about every store shelf, and the company has donated $150 million to charity. Nell came on board in the early 90s as co-president of the Organic Division. You may have seen her and her dad on Oh Cookie Boxes, posing as that American Gothic couple from the Grant Woods painting. And Nell Newman joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. My pleasure.
My favorite, Fig Newman's. Now, is it true that your dad sort of helped in, because I was always wondering, how could you take the name that's so close to Fig Newton's?
We had to ask for permission.
Yeah.
He did help with that.
Yeah. And how did you come, because it was your idea to do the organic branch, and I understand your dad wasn't that thrilled about it at first. How did you come to your passion for organic food?
Because when I was 10 years old, I discovered the peregrine falcon was almost extinct east of the Mississippi due to the use of DDT. I think that's where my interest came from, my early interest, to realize that mankind could have such a tremendous effect on the environment through the process of growing our food.
Do I understand you had a falcon? Your parents let you have a falcon growing up in
Connecticut? I was a falconer for many years.
How else did your parents influence you?
They're very charitable and wonderful human beings. I mean, I think that's how I learned about philanthropy. The odd thing was they never talked about it. I didn't know my dad had a foundation in the 60s and 70s called the Nonesuch Foundation. You know, but he's always been philanthropic. Both of them showed by example.
They just lived it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. They showed by example by just being generous human beings, but they didn't talk about it.
I want to ask you about your other influences. I mean, obviously your dad is mm-hmm. one, but I understand Alice Waters as well, restaurateur Alice Waters.
She was one of my early inspirations, and it just came from eating her restaurant, just from going in there and having, you know, what is, you know, one of your best meals. And you don't walk out saying, gee, that was the healthiest thing I ever ate or, you know, the best thing for me. You just walk out and saying that was one of the best meals I've ever had.
Right.
And the example is just that she uses the best produce. She's probably close to 100% organic at this point. And, you know, it's just the produce that shines through. And that's where we came up with our motto, great tasting products that happen to be organic.
Well, from organic food, you've expanded. You're working with the Green Mountain Company out of Vermont to buy fair trade coffee. Fair trade meaning?
That a farmer be paid a living wage for whatever it is that he's growing. In particular, it usually, in this particular case, it means coffee. Coffee market being so depressed in the past 10 years that it was one of the crucial ways of making sure that somebody who was growing your coffee would be able to make a living, send his kids to school. Right. And continue to work.
So too many beans means too low a price for the small farmers.
Yes. Right. And it gives them a set price And ours is organic and fair trade.
What challenges does it give you that you've committed to fair trade?
Finding a good source, which is why we work with Green Mountain, because they have a lot of experience with going to source. I went to Guatemala to see where some of our coffee was grown around Lake Atitlan, and that was a fantastic trip. It's called Going to Source, and I got to go and see where the coffee was grown. I got to meet the cooperative. We cupped coffee for them because they don't get to try their own coffee because they send it all out of the country. And it was wonderful. Then we stood around and made speeches about how appreciative we were because, you know, they don't have a lot of people that go to Source and see what they're doing. It was really fantastic and discussed how this enables them to continue their process to put money back into the farm to send their kids to school.
Because you pledged to buy the coffee at a certain price that's a living wage.
Yes.
Nell Newman, I'm wondering if, as a young person, you ever saw yourself taking this road, because I'm reading about a pretty rebellious, well, how would you characterize your high school years?
Oh, disaster. Went back, oh, well, I just went to a different school every year, so I dropped out when I was a sophomore. Got my GED in my 20s and then went to college.
And then how did you come to join your dad's company?
I was a frustrated fundraiser for a small nonprofit. So that's how it came to be, out of frustration of doing, you know, what public radio does when they're trying to raise money.
Tell me about it.
It's really frustrating. So I did. I looked at what Pop was doing. I thought, wow, that sounds great. And, you know, I'd like to do a little differently and utilize organic ingredients and then support worthy causes. So that's what I did.
Which causes do you support?
Everything from the Organic Farming Research Foundation to, you know, Habitat for Humanity. It's really broad. It's great fun. It's, you know, it's become more work because it's much more competitive business now.
Well, I was going to ask you, we talked about the fair trade coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And even Dunkin' Donuts, you know, is jumping on the fair trade, thankfully, jumping mm-hmm. on the fair trade bandwagon. But well, I'm wondering, what does that do for boutique companies like yours?
I think it's great because it benefits the farmer, and that's what the purpose of it is. So if Dunkin' Donuts is going to buy fair trade coffee, that, you know, the more people on the bandwagon, the better, as far as I'm concerned. Basically, it's grow or die in the natural foods industry.
What hasn't worked?
100% organic tortilla chips. Because people buy tortilla chips based on price, and everybody really liked them a lot but didn't want to buy them because they always buy whatever's on sale.
Yeah, that's true. You just buy the biggest bag of tortilla chips.
And that was a hard lesson because I thought they were great, and I thought we were the only one on the market.
Nell Newman, businesswoman in her own right and philanthropist, but also daughter, as we've said, of Paul Newman, Joanne Woodward. I can't let you go without discussing your film career. I saw it. Wait, what's the name of it again? The Moonbeams one?
The Effect of Gamma Rays on Man in the Moon Marigolds.
That's it. I saw that. You played the...
I played Matilda.
The science...
I was typecast, the science nerd. It's pretty good, actually.
Yeah, it is. Nell Newman, co-founder and president of Newman's Own Organics. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Nell, thank you.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Matt Largy, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Kate Goldring and Danielle Dreilinger. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.